From Public Radio International, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The Indian novelist Amitav Ghosh is a wise man at several gateways. First, the passage between Calcutta, where he grew up, and New York, where he now mostly lives and writes. Second, he's posted himself as an imaginative historian between the end of the British Raj in India in the last century and the launch of an even more universal American imperium today. Third, Amitav Ghosh is a guide at the gap between our several simplified slogans about India, high-tech and outsource India, Gandhi's India, nuclear India, but also village India of ancient sorcery, real ever-lethal Bengal tigers, and all-encompassing poverty. India today is only a keystroke away from the American economy, a tsunami away from the world's emergency attention. With Amitav Ghosh, a modern passage to India is next on Open Source. First, the news. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're the radio show with a bit of internet attitude. We're a website with the sound of human conversation on it at radioopensource.org. The conversation this hour encompasses India and us. Our guest, Amitav Ghosh, is one of those very big theme novelists who works at the epic and prophetic scale. His new novel, called The Hungry Tide, is set in the tidal islands at the mouth of the Ganges River. Please join the conversation by phone or on the web from Boston or Bombay. Our phone is 877-673-6767. We're making a sort of passage to India, past the headlines, past the curry, past the Taj Mahal. Amitav Ghosh, welcome.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be on your show.
Well, thank you. The Hungry Tide is a great storm of ideas and people, but leave the book aside for a moment. It's just as compelling to me that you are on your way back to India yourself for the rest of this year. If you were taking us with you, what would you want to show us about your India, or what are you looking to discover for yourself this time?
Well, to be honest, my intention is just to go to my house in India and spend a very quiet few months just trying to write, really. So I wouldn't
walk us around it. Walk us around the neighborhood.
Well, my neighborhood has really changed so much. In a way, it's really sort of characteristic of what's happened to Indian cities. I mean, in the 1960s, when we first moved into this house, it was like on the outskirts of Calcutta, and you could hear, you know, foxes and jackals calling at night. Now it's like the beating heart of the city. You know, there are huge developments all around it. There are massive sort of industrial parks and flyovers, and, you know, you can get pizza delivered. I mean,
I remember when,
well, I don't eat pizza myself, but, you know, when my children are very happy about it, certainly. You know, when that sort of thing started, like, it's just about 5 or 6 years since fast food came into India. It's an interesting thing that, in a way, fast food, too, has been very sort of... You know, it's been very particular in India because whereas Indians have taken to some kinds of fast food, we've also been very, very powerfully resistant to some other kinds, like KFC's faced a lot of trouble in India.
This is interesting. One of the characters in The Hungry Tide runs a translation service for international businesses in New Delhi, and he's got an accent modification school for Indians who are working in these call centers. But that's rather exceptional in the book. For the most part, the India that you're writing about, in this book anyway, is another world of food and philosophy and nature and environmental clashes and spirit life, all destined, it seemed to me, to stick to its own reality for the foreseeable future. What should we know about that place?
Well, that's a very good question, Chris. You know, when we speak of India as just, you know, when we just use the one word for it, it seems as though it's, you know, you can sum it all up, but you really can't. I mean, India's like, India's continents, India's centuries, India's history, you know, it's really a continent unto itself. And there are such vast differences between one part of India and the other, you know. India, for example, I'm from the eastern part of India, from Calcutta.
And one of those Bengali intellectuals, a famous breed unto themselves, yeah.
But, you know, Bengal's produced a number of intellectuals, but Bengal's also been, you know, one of the poorest parts of India for a very long time. And it's very striking that, you know, even to this day, when you go from, say, Calcutta to some cities on the West Coast or to Bangalore, you really feel that you're traveling you're traveling into another world, into another sort of century of progress. So there's a vast difference. But, you know, I feel very grateful that, you know, in a sense, I am from a part of India which is still very much, very deeply connected with its rural roots, with its, you know, with its history. Because I think if you are in a place like Bangalore or if you are in a place like Bombay, it's very easy to to imagine that that surging tide of popular culture and that surging tide of rising incomes and so on, that that is the real India. But, you know, it's an aspect of India, but it's not the only aspect by any means.
I was just going to say, I mean, would you say that the Bengali India is the real thing? Do you want to make a...
No. By no means. I don't think one can privilege one aspect of, you know, one part of India over another. What I would say, though, is this, that India is still overwhelmingly a rural country. The vast majority of India's population, I think it's something like 80%, continues to live in the countryside. The vast majority of people in India still derive their incomes from agriculture. So, you know, in some absolute statistical sense, it is true that India is a rural agricultural country and a country which is, you know, very, very poor, really. Now, it's an odd thing that this part of India, this aspect of India really is the part of India that's not in public focus, that's not
exactly.
That's not represented.
Not online, probably not listening to this radio program.
But
I wish you'd introduce us. I mean, there's so much of me that wants to go to India with you.
Well, I can understand why, because India is, you know, to me, really, in the end, you know, it's a universe unto itself. It's endlessly fascinating. People often ask me, you know, are you going to write a book about, you know, about Europe or America or somewhere? And, you know, the fact of the matter is, I don't think I ever will, because I just find, you know, there's so much to be said about India that I don't think I'll ever run out of stories. I don't think one could.
Speak of the goddess who has almost a speaking part in this novel of The Hungry Tide. I mean, there's a vividly active life of spirit and mythology sort of at work in the minds of your characters.
Yes, well, you know, the people of the Sundarbans, and I should explain here, the Sundarbans is where my novel The Hungry Tide is set. And the Sundarbans are an astonishing part of India, one of the most amazing ecosystems in the whole world, I think. It's this vast mangrove forest that, you know, that forms the littoral of Bengal. It's the kind of coastline. It's the barrier between Bengal and the sea. And over here, in this mangrove forest, it's one of the reasons why it's really well known is because it's home to 600 tigers, many of whom are man-eaters. So, you know, when you're in this forest, there's a very real sense of the danger, of the threat of carnivores. You know, people are attacked every day, people are killed every day. So people have a very active and real fear of the natural world, if you like. But one of the ways in which they mediate this fear is through a complex of beliefs, which is centered upon a goddess who's known as Bunbibi. And what I find absolutely wonderful about this entire complex of worship is that Bunbibi, who's really in some sense a Hindu goddess, is said to have come from Saudi Arabia. She's said to be a Muslim saint who came from Saudi Arabia and became a goddess in Bengal. And, you know, that story, that passage is in itself so fascinating. The way in which Bunbibi is represented to have come from across the seas to Bengal, that it did become actually a central part of my book.
Yeah, and the liturgy, if I recall from the book, is sort of done in a language that encompasses Persian and Arabic.
Yes, I remember, you know, some 5 years ago, you know, the day on which which the puja or the ritual of worship for Bunbibi, the day when it's held, it's on the 15th of January, roughly. And the people who do this ritual actually go deep into the forest. And I went with them. And, you know, once the ritual started, I was astonished to see that, you know, it began by people chanting in the name of Allah, you know. And these were nominally Hindu people. So it was an astonishing thing to see, you know, the ways in which cultural traditions really merge with each other. And this was particularly exciting then because at that point we had a kind of a Hindu fundamentalist government in power in New Delhi. And, you know, they were trying to spread this idea that, you know, that religious traditions in India are so far apart that they have no point of meeting. And, you know, it was just palpable. It was there in front of my eyes where you could see that, you know, Hindus and Muslims have for millennia created places of meeting, you know?
Mm. You're, if I may be so bold, I mean, you're the sort of novelist who is always looking for the future. And I read you in a certain fashion, looking for the future, or looking for a prophecy. And I just wonder, Amitabh Ghosh, what you yourself hope to discover in this trip to Calcutta about India's future, or India's relationship with us in the future, or a world under American domination of the future. What are you looking for?
I think people in India have very mixed feelings. On the one hand, you know, many, many young Indians come to study in America, and they leave, I think, on the whole, with very, very positive ideas about America. They're very well received here. They feel a sense of hospitality. They feel a sense of opportunity. They feel, you know, they feel an enormous kind of a sense of an opening, as it were, when they come to America. At the same time, and, you know, when we speak of one Indian who's here, you can say that each of them has a family of, you know, 200-300, you know, a circle of family and friends who are also in some way vicariously experiencing America through their relatives. So those are very, very positive things. And I think, you know, many millions of Indians have this very positive idea of America. At the same time, I think the way that American foreign policy has been conducted in these last 4 or 5 years has been very, very detrimental to America's image. I mean, as you know, that's been true of the world at large, but it's also been true particularly, I think, in India.
What form does it take? Well, what's the expression of it?
Well, there's no, I mean, certainly there's not been the kind of, violent expression of anti-Americanism. And I don't think there is a violent sense of anti-Americanism in India at all. In fact, quite the contrary. There's really a sense of bewilderment, rather, that, you know, how have these guys got themselves into something which is just so clearly a catastrophe? And because, you know, the reason why I, as an Indian, feel so concerned about the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan is that, you know, this catastrophe, America is a long, long way from it. Even if the worst comes to the worst and they leave, they'll be far, far away from there. But this catastrophe is on our doorsteps. And in fact, it's countries like India that will be paying the price of these mistakes for decades into the future.
I want to hear lots more about that after the break. We're talking with the Indian novelist, now rooted in New York, Amitabh Ghosh. His new book is called The Hungry Tide. Join us by phone at 877-673-6767 or log on to our website, radioopensource.org. Make a comment or give us a call. We'll be back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about India and the United States with the novelist Amitabh Ghosh. His new book is The Hungry Tide. Dilip D'Souza joins us by phone from Bombay. He's a freelance writer and a blogger and an observer of India Today. Dilip D'Souza, thank you for joining us. We enjoy your blog.
Well, I should say good morning, but I really should say good afternoon or good evening, whatever it is in Boston.
Tell us a story off your blog or your eyeball observation today.
You know, I've been listening so far to what Amitabh has been saying. I'm a great admirer, by the way.
Dilip, get off the speakerphone onto the handset.
I'm a great admirer of Amitabh and of what he said so far. I've been listening to what he's been saying, and I think there's a lot of truth there, and I want to echo some of that. I want to say that there are these alternative realities in India that a lot of people are not so aware of, and I think it's time that people were aware of that, because that contributes to a greater understanding of this country.
Give us a picture.
Well, You know, it's now, what, about 4:45 in the morning here in Bombay, and I could go out on the street, and I know this, I could walk out and it's dark outside, and there are road dividers outside on which I would find people asleep, or I need to just go a little way away to find people strung along the road, sleeping at night on the road. This is still a reality in urban India, and it's, one aspect of India is that it's a largely rural country, but another aspect is that even in urban India, there is sort of in-your-face poverty, which, it's not that I'm saying this to say that this is an entirely poor country, but I'm saying it to say that this is another aspect of India, and there is this whole business of outsourcing and BPO and call centers, but there is also people living on the street and people sleeping on the street and people coming into your railway compartment and cleaning the floor to earn a few coins of money and cleaning the floor with the shirts off their back. You know, things like this. This is also India, and I have to live with that every day. It's not that it sort of gets me down, but this is. I wish somehow, sometimes, that we see all these different aspects of India.
So that's very well said, Dilip.
Well, who said that? Take away the ocean, and Bombay is just one infinite slum, and yet somehow a very vivid life goes on. Where is it heading? How do you reconcile these? These trends or these realities of Bombay?
Reconciliation is something that I think all Indians have learned to come to terms with. We grow up learning to reconcile these things in our minds. One way of saying that is to ignore some of these realities, but I don't want to say that. I really would like to use that word reconciliation. We learn to reconcile these different aspects of India and go on with our life because we have to.
Mm.
And so there is, in that sense, that reconciliation is just part of our reality, part of our living in India every day.
Amitav Ghosh, can I ask you just a very general question? What sort of model is India, with all its contradictions, would you say, for the post-colonial world today, most particularly the Arab Middle East and for Africa too?
Well, that's a very good question, Chris. I must say, the more I observe India, the longer I look at India, and I'm not saying this from a sort of chauvinistic point of view at all. I'm rather saying this from a sense of genuine appreciation and wonder. The more I watch India, the more amazed I am at really the incredible good sense, I would say, in the end, of Indian people. For example, you know, this last election that we had in India, the way that, that people decided, that the great majority of Indians decided to preserve our pluralistic traditions, the way that they actually sort of voted out a fundamentalist government and a government which was, projected to come roaring back to power. But in fact, rural people in India just said that we're not taken in by this. We are, secularism means something to us, pluralism means something to us, and, we want to preserve it. So, I think the most astonishing thing about India is that here we have a country which has hundreds of different languages, hundreds of different ways of thought, of belief, of living. And yet somehow we are able to not just to carry on, but actually to have genuine and meaningful conversations with each other.
It's interesting, at a moment when the United States seems to be ready to inflict democracy a lot of places, how would India, I mean, the biggest, most populous democracy in the world, coming out of a colonial past, how would India begin teaching its tolerance, its pluralism, its democracy?
See, I think the first thing that any Indian would looks at when you think of, say, creating democracy or whatever, is that it's not that the end is bad. I mean, the idea of having a democratic society is a very good one. But what matters most is the means. What means are you using? And this is something that, comes to us from Gandhi. Gandhi taught us again and again that there is no difference between ends and means. People who think that any means is justifiable if the end is justifiable, those are the people you have to most profoundly distrust. So when we are told that democracy is going to be created by a bloody war which will take tens of thousands of lives, people in India know that what you get from that is not democracy. What you get from that is just an unholy mess where, in fact, you'll postpone the possibility of democracy by 50 or 60 years. You know, democracy just is not just a gift. It's not something that people can go and, you know, ram down someone else's throat. Mm-hmm. Democracy is a process which you learn. And one of the ways in which you learn it is the ways in which you acquire it. And this is what happened for us, you know, in our opposition to imperialism for the last over a period of 100 years. Indians worked out these strategies, these ways of dealing with each other. Mm. And that's why it became something that we could keep and preserve.
The phone is 877-673-6767. Our guest is the Indian novelist Amitav Ghosh. David is calling from San Francisco.
Hey, good. It's really good to hear your voice, Chris, back on the air.
Thank you, David.
Hey, I've just read a book, which is one of the best books I've read in some time now, called The Maximum City, about Bombay, and I wonder if you or your guest had read it.
I have read it.
And I think you probably agree then that it's a great read.
It's a fantastic read. It's sort of like one long sort of magazine tour through the nightlife, the prostitution, the gangsterism.
The Bollywood, and also the Hindu fundamentalist. And he ends with an amazing account of, he's a Jainist himself, I think, I'm talking about Mehta, who wrote the book, about a giveaway in which I guess it's some kind of tradition in which a wealthy Jainist will give away everything. In fact, everything he has, but in a whole series of elaborate rituals. And in fact, his whole family disappears, and they just walk off. And I just wondered if Amitav, you're talking about another pirate of India, about Calcutta and Delhi, I think. And I wonder how you connect that. He also talks about the goddess also, and the goddess in that point between the Muslim and the Hindus. And what do you think?
Can they be connected?
I think it's a wonderful book. In fact, I blurbed it. And you'll be interested to know, Chris, that the study that you came to last time, Suketu actually had that study for a while and wrote a part of the book in that. So I think it's a wonderful book. It's full of excitement, and it's full of wonderful nuggets of Bombay life. At the same time, I do think that it's an amazing thing that Suketu presents such a vivid and magnificent picture of Bombay, and we have increasingly an increasingly vivid picture of Indian urban life. But it's again what I would come back to, that if you even look inside India, for the Indians who are writing about rural life in India, there's so very few. In fact, there's only one major journalist in India who actually covers rural India on a regular basis. It's a wonderful writer called Sainath. But, it's this sense, I think, which I would also, while celebrating, the progress of India's urban centers, I would also say that I do think it's very sad that, India's rural life is increasingly neglected.
Fair enough. Kamala is on the line. Full name, Kamala Visvesvaran, from Austin, Texas. She teaches anthropology at the University of Texas. Kamala, join the conversation on India Today and how it got this way.
Sure. Thanks for asking me to join, Chris. And I'd like also to say hello to Dilip and Amitav.
Hi, Kamala.
Hey, guys.
Hi there.
I think both Dilip and Amitav have been saying some really interesting things, and I just wanted to pick up on something Amitav just said about democracy being a tradition, an Indian tradition that is kept alive. And when I think about India, I think about some of the popular images in media where, one estimate has it that India's middle class is four times the entire population of France. It's also a land of diversity, so it's produced an Indian woman prime minister, and yet more than half of all Indian women are illiterate, which doesn't, of course, mean that they're without agency or lack knowledge. And I think one of the legacies that modern India has, dating from the times of anti-colonial struggle, is really a strong tradition of social movements. And I think in different ways, Dilip's writing has spoken to that, and Amitav's as well. But women have also been at the forefront of those popular struggles. And, you know, even in terms of thinking about keeping a democracy alive and vibrant, many social movements seek to call for greater government accountability, fight to work against corruption. If you think about the court system, the judiciary, India is fairly unique in having a system where any Indian citizen can actually petition the highest court of the land, the Supreme Court, and ask to have their grievance heard or addressed. And in fact, the Indian Supreme Court has risen to that challenge and has really acted on a number of cases that involve public interest litigation, so that issues concerning sexual harassment, women's rights, environmental rights, the right to housing, the right to food, the right to work can be addressed by a judiciary as a kind of nudge to push the government along. And so public interest litigation is also something that social movements increasingly use in the struggle for women's rights, among other things.
Kamala, I wonder, what's the sort of leading edge of women's organization in India today? What are the issues? What's the struggle?
Well, I think it's a great question. It's difficult to answer. Many women's issues can't really be separated from environmental issues, from labor issues, from issues around corporate accountability. So if you looked at the history of the Bhopal gas leak, for example, two of the women organizers who just received the Goldman Environmental Prize were women who had been two of the gas victims and had actually worked to mobilize their communities over a 20-year period, demanding that Union Carbide pay up, clean up the environmental damage that was done in Bhopal, fund clinics, et cetera, et cetera. And there are numerous instances like this around India where you see local-level movements really calling for greater accountability, and I think that's intrinsic to democracy, and it's something that's really lacking in the United States right now.
Amitav Ghosh, I wonder if you want to talk about some of the environmental issues in your book. And part of it is sort of whether, I mean, there's an international movement that protects the Bengal tigers in some sense more zealously than it protects the lives of the people who die of the tigers practically every day or every week. And then there's a huge issue around, in your book, around the security of the dolphins. Those environmental issues cut complicated ways in your book. Do you want to jump in on that?
Sure, absolutely. There are many strains of environmentalism in India as there are in the world, but one of the dominant strain so far has been a kind of patrician and elite environmentalism, where really you have the old Maharaja class sort of getting involved in kind of, protecting forests and so on. What this has meant is that increasingly, there's an approach to environmentalism, a sort of state approach to environmentalism in India, where rural people, where people who've traditionally lived in forests find themselves forcibly evicted from their traditional grazing lands, their traditional hunting lands, their traditional fishing lands. And these people are just absolutely thrust out of these areas. They're pushed away. They're not given any kind of compensation, really, and they're not given any alternative forms of livelihood. Now, this is based upon an idea of a forest, where you think of a forest as something which is so primeval and primordial that it has no interaction with human beings. But we know now that there are actually no forests anywhere in the world of that kind. Forests emerge out of some sort of interaction with human beings. So I feel, now, what happens actually when you do create a reserve forest like this, where the people have been thrust out, where the dispossessed people have been thrust out? It's not as though it ceases to have any kind of human interaction. All that happens is that you have tourists moving in, you have hotels moving in. In this famous forest called Ranthambore in India, if you drive through this forest, you'll see entire villages which have literally been cleansed of human beings. But you have, on the other hand, huge hotels catering to tourists, mainly to first world tourists, because they can afford it. So in effect, what you have over there is an exchange of populations, really, a form of, you could almost say an ethnic cleansing. Now, this issue became very live for me in the Sundarbans, because, the Sundarbans, there are many, many desperately poor people there who need to make their livelihood from, just collecting firewood or catching fish or whatever. And because of the structure of the legal structure of forestry in India, they find themselves just constantly, at the receiving end. Now, whatever the danger may be to and the danger to forests in India is very real, and we must all be concerned with preserving, those aspects of our natural environment that still exist. But I feel that what we have to now look at Indian environmentalism much more from the ground up and find ways of restoring, human use within forests, or finding a way of, ensuring that the poorest people in our society don't pay the price environmental preservation.
Amitav Ghosh, stand by for a caller. Lorraine is on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome, Lorraine.
Oh, good evening. Thank you so much for this program. It brings back to me a question of an empowerment technique that I heard about over, National Public Radio, and I've never heard anybody mention it since. It's done by Mohammed Yunus, who of the Grameen Bank. He'll rent out a telephone to a woman in a village, one of those villages that's very poor and a lot of people have left for the big city, and she can rent it out to other villagers, and she pays Mohammed Yunus rent for it. And then when she's paid in rent the amount the phone cost, in his view, she can keep it. So she has a cottage industry that empowers her and the other women in the village or the other villagers, and they can stay, among other things, they can stay in touch with their relatives who've left for the city. And so I see the same kind of empowerment in the movie Born into Brothels,
Lorraine, it's an interesting point. I mean, micro-lending and the Grameen Bank is one of the great gifts of modern India. Who wants to claim credit for that?
Modern Bangladesh, I think. We must be clear there. The Grameen Banks were invented in Bangladesh.
Yeah, although microcredit, I think, has become very popular throughout South Asia, and it's certainly common in India and Pakistan and Sri Lanka. But yes, Amitav's right. It definitely originated in Bangladesh.
In Bangladesh.
Well, we'll give the Bengalis generally credit for that, Amitav. I mean, when we come back after break, I'd like you all to fix on sort of the message from India and not only the Grameen Bank and microlending, but the gift of perspective and sort of survival out of an imperial era into this new one. Can we talk about that, Amitav?
I mean, by all means.
Good.
Sure.
Yes, certainly.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about India and us, our view of them, theirs of ours, and the fact that we're all much, much closer to each other than we used to be thanks to the Internet. This is Open Source. Our phone is 877-673-6767, or you can join us online at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with Amitav Ghosh, the novelist from India, on his way back to India, lives half his life in New York now. We're talking about the India-American connection, and I'm particularly interested in sort of the message from India, including the literary message. I mean, fiction out of India has been hugely important for a long time, since Kipling. I mean, and all the more today with Michael Ondaatje or Rohinton Mystery or Salman Rushdie. I'm especially interested in what India wants to tell us and what India's great writers want to tell us, Amitav. Especially us, the new empire.
I'm very, very intrigued by the ways that India is increasingly represented in America. For example, just a couple of days ago, I saw this column by Thomas Friedman where he says, India's just developed this volcanic hunger because of 40 years of socialism. And now Indian engineers are just desperately hungry to swallow up every kind of job they can get. And this is just such a profound misrepresentation, of what India is and what India is going to be, even. For one thing, you know, it's so interesting that people talk about the 40 years following upon decolonization without mentioning the 20 decades of imperialism that preceded it. You know, in those 20 decades of imperialism, Indians were systematically discouraged from following technical education, you know. No technical institutes were set up. Indians were, Indian scientists who went abroad were followed by British intelligence agents. So, you know, one of the real lessons, I think, of what happened in India after decolonization is that, you know, under state initiative, these institutes were set up, the four Indian Institutes of Technology, which have really pioneered the entire information technology boom around the world. Similarly, there was a massive kind of investment in, not enough, but there was certainly a major investment in education across India. So, you know, I think for me, really, the one major lesson that comes out of the Indian experience is, in the first place, we must be skeptical. When American prophets start telling us that their way is the only way and it's the best way, we have to be skeptical, because the one lesson that we can see from our own history is that every country has to find its own way. There is no one size fits all. You know, progress, development, these are all difficult things. These are very difficult matters where every country has to find its own way forward.
Dilip D'Souza in Bombay, do you want a last word before you go to bed?
Do I what?
Do you want a last word before you turn the lights out?
Before I go to bed. Well, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to go back to bed after the stimulating conversation. I would like to actually respond to something that Amitav said a few minutes ago, where he mentioned Sainath, the only journalist who covers rural India, and that's true. But Amitav, there are some of us who, whether inspired by Sainath or not, who are also doing our best to cover some of these rural issues, and we see that as our job, in a sense, you know.
I'm very glad to hear that.
So I just wanted to say that.
Dilip, what is the message from India for us? I mean, Amitav just made an eloquent kind of skeptical plea. What's yours?
Well, skepticism is one part of it. I mean, I think that's a message for the world. Everybody must be more skeptical than they are of various things. But I think for me, let me just say, what do I try to do as a journalist, as a writer here in India? My job, what I feel like I need to do, what I have to do, is to get a broader picture of India out, because I'm tired of this this notion that we are some emerging superpower, and I mean, there is a truth to that, but there is a greater truth that I think it's my job to get out to the world, and or to get out to my readers at any rate. And so I don't really concern myself with some unique message coming out of India. I concern myself with telling the stories that I see around me.
You've got a wonderful vehicle, Dilip, in the Internet, and we love your blog. Thank you for joining us. The phone's 877-673-6767. Amandeep Singh joins us by phone from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. He teaches English and post-colonial literature at Lehigh University, and he blogs about India. Amardeep, I'm fascinated with the message from India. Now, I mean, we used to have Anglo-Indian writers like Kipling. Now we have Indo-Anglian writers.
That's right, Indo-Anglian, yes.
What are they telling us? What should we be hearing?
Well, I think if you're asking what the message is from India, first of all, I should say hello to Amitav, say hello to Dilip that we just left, and Kamala as well. I think that there's no one message. I think that's the message to get across. And you look at the kind of current generation of Indian writers or South Asian writers, and there's an incredible breadth of interests and topics and styles that they use. And I mean, I think Ghosh is among the leading lights of that movement. And he and one of the things that you see if you read all of his books is, even in his own corpus, there is an incredible array of varieties of styles and interests and themes and even messages, if you will. There's no one message there. So I think that's one of, if you look at the literature, you really find that there is a real diversity of ideas that's afoot, that are available right now, and they're all over the place. In terms of politics and the issues we've been discussing so far in the program, I think that might also apply there as well. There's no one new India. There's no one kind of story to tell. I think whether we're talking about the slums of Bombay or the rural poor or the sort of new emerging kind of technocratic class of sort of high-tech workers, as well as kind of the sort of various kinds of new industries that have been emerging, and the sort of new enthusiasm and entrepreneurialism in the middle classes in India. I mean, there's a really divergent story there, and it's very difficult to align the two developments. And I think,
but Amardeep, can I ask you just a simple question, which is, I have puzzled that we've not heard more out of the post-colonial world, not just India, but Africa, the Caribbean, in the way of caution about this imperial adventure that Bush and Cheney and the American thrust seems to be headed for. I mean, where are those many Nobel writers out of the third world saying, you know, we've been there and we're not going back?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think writers like Ghosh have spoken out. He has written a couple of important comments or kind of op-eds, as it were, on the Iraq War over the past couple of years. And a lot of other writers have also expressed their opinions. Rushdie has also voiced his opinion on this issue. I think if you look at writers, say, within India and the sort of intellectual scene in India, a lot of the concern is actually inwardly directed. What do we do about the problems in our own society? What do we do about this homeless problem in the big cities? What do we do about the sort of competing demands of development and kind of some sort of sense of cultural integrity? There are a lot of questions that people are trying to answer that pertain to their own society. There's a kind of common fallacy that many Americans have, which is that everyone else in the world is worried about what America is doing. A lot of the intellectual scene in India is concerned about this, very much so. But and if you read the Indian media on a daily basis, you see that people are thinking, okay, well, what can we do about this particular problem that we're dealing with today, the water problem, the electricity problem? So that might be part of the answer to that question.
Amitav, does that sound right?
Look, the fact of the matter is that many, many Nobel Prize winners have spoken out against this war. Amartya Sen has. I couldn't even begin to count. What has actually happened in America is that voices which have been speaking, alternative points of view have literally been shut out. I mean, I've experienced at first hand this whole process of just being silenced, having one say.
And it's have you experienced it? What do you mean?
Well, I'll tell you, in March 2003, just before the war began, I wrote this piece for The New Yorker in which I was, in which I made this analogy between, this plan of this war and, empire. And I said that, the reason why empire is not going to work right now is because there isn't that disparity in armaments that existed in the 19th century. There isn't that disparity in forms of knowledge that existed in the 19th century. There's no way this can be made to work today. And I remember, when I sent this off to the New Yorker, their first response was to say, well, this is great. But then they called me back and said, we would like you to put in a paragraph right at the start of this piece. So I said, what's this paragraph? And they said, the paragraph is, and they'd written it out for me. They said, the paragraph is that America is not like the empires of the past, because unlike the empires of the past, America is not acting in its own self-interest. And when I heard this, I was so astonished. It just revealed to me the absolute, as it were, the absolute ignorance that people, really, that many elite Americans have in relation to history. Because, I said to them that, it's not that you're being unfair to America, you're being unfair to the empires of the past. They all thought that they were acting in someone else's interest.
Yeah, amen. They always thought it was the first time. They always thought there was an innocent experiment going on.
One of the things one can't help remember is just how strangely deceptive this whole talk about the delivery of freedom can be, because you just have to remember that in the 18th century in America, slavery was defended on the grounds that it was actually delivering the Africans into freedom from Africa by taking them away from Africa.
877-673-6767 is our phone. Navjeet is calling from Southborough, Massachusetts. Navjeet, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. This is an excellent show, and I'm enjoying it.
Thank you.
I wanted to comment on one thing. I mean, you have been asking about the message from India. And I appreciate the fact that Amardeep made already that there's no one message. But I also think another observation I have is that the message that Indians want America or people outside the country to get is often one message, and the reality can often be different.
Meaning what?
Just as an example, the fact that in information technology, India is doing so well is definitely important, and it's very important for the self-confidence of people in India. But the impact it has on the local economy, one might argue, may be dramatically overstated. For example, there's fewer than 1 million people employed in software and software-related services that are exported to America, while, you know, the unemployment rolls alone have 40 million, and Bangalore may seem like the richest state, but the highest income in India is still in a state in northern India, in Punjab, where the change really has been brought about more by agriculture. So in many ways...
You say only 1 million Indian workers involved in information technology for export?
Is about, according to... is less than 1 million. It's about 800,000.
That's fascinating. Amitav, that sound right?
Yeah, it sounds absolutely right. But I would say here that, you know, in fact, I don't know, you know, I'm not an economist. I can't read the statistics. One thing you certainly can see in India over the last 5 or 10 years is that the amount of disposable income that people have, it's just, I mean, it's just skyrocketed. And it's much more than 1 million people who have more disposable income. You even see it in rural areas. So, I mean, there can be no denying that the expansion of the economy really has had very important effects. The one thing that I would want to say here is that, you know, in America, increasingly, India and China are being held up as kind of bugbears. You know, they become like the boogeymen, like they're waiting to take away American jobs. I think this is just so misleading. In the first place, you know, India is a huge market internally. And as this market develops, Indians, I think, will become less and less interested in catering to foreign markets. Secondly, you know, in America, people work incredibly hard as well. I mean, you know, you have 12, you have people who work 10, 12, 11, 12-hour days. And I don't see that, you know, in any sense, Indian patterns of labor are going to be a serious threat to America over the short term.
Amardeep,
yes.
I'm interested in other, you know, voices from India that we don't know and ought to know. And this is a moment to hear your sort of your reading list.
You mean other literary voices or other
either one, journalistic or?
That's interesting. Well, there, I think one of the things your show has been trying to do, as in its very brief life, has been to bring in voices from all over the world through the internet and through that medium. And I think, for instance, Dilip D'Souza, as you know, we've already talked about his work. You know, as a blogger and as well as a mainstream journalist, has been really impressive and really salutary. He's really told a lot of stories that a lot of people aren't talking about. He's talked about some things that are very negative, but also, for instance, he talked very recently about a small dam project that was done by a couple of engineers who had graduated from one of the prestigious universities and had gone to a village and built a little dam to help the village have electricity because the government was having trouble bringing it there. And that became the inspiration for a major film that was released called Swadesh just last year. So he's an interesting voice, and I think there are many that you can find. If you go through his page, you can find a lot of interesting voices linked there and so on. And there's a whole universe emerging through the internet and through the Indian media online that people can look to.
Thank you. Peter is calling from Danville, New Hampshire.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Look, I thought that Amitai Ghosh's remark on ends and means was particularly pregnant, and I'm anxious to hear one singularly humane voice speak on what he sees as some lessons for us Americans on the matter of the kind of politics I've tried to deal with in a book of my own, where I actually reflect on the ends and means dichotomy, and I say too much of American politics rests on the assumption that the end justifies the means, which I think is fundamentally unethical. So that's my position. But if Amitai could just imagine himself for a moment to be like an Indian de Tocqueville, observing American democracy, and making some suggestions to us as to the process, you know, the means, and how he sees the means in India and how they might help us improve our own democracy.
Peter, it's a great grateful. Question. Amitav, can you answer it?
Yeah, certainly I'll try to address it. You know, my concern about the way that ends and means were being deployed by America really began not in the Bush era but in the Clinton era. When suddenly, there were these unilateral interventions where these unilateral interventions were actually supported by American liberals. And it was then that I became really, really concerned. And I wrote a couple of articles in The Nation saying that, you know, one thing you have to remember is that imperialism is always spearheaded by liberals. That's something that we tend to forget. But throughout the 18th century and the 19th century, this has always been the case. And, you know, I think in some strange way, that's also been true in America. It's simply because so many American liberals forgot that the issue of ends cannot be given primacy over means. So, you know, for me, the real touchstone here is not that intervention is unnecessary. It's rather what are the means by which interventions are made legal or illegal.
We're going to think hard about it. And I don't want you to forget us in your travels either. I'd love to continue this conversation. I'd love to continue all the conversations with the Indian bloggers, too. So Godspeed to you, and come back to the program soon. Listeners, you can visit our blog at radioopensource.org. You can become a source yourself. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and by WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, training practitioners and students for leadership in human rights. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Robin Amer, and Chelsea Mers. We had help from Ray Fallon, Tom Devlin, and Miles Smith at WGBH. Thanks also to Jake Shapiro, Vin Ryan, Ted Henderson, and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.